You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Janine Basinger returns to the show this week. She's a brilliant film historian and the author of some of the best books about film, including I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage in the Movies. Her latest book is not only a great read, but it's a book that you'll return to again and again, and it'll inspire you to seek out the films that she discusses and discover some great cinema. The book is The Movie Musical. It's got an exclamation point on it, so I should say The Movie Musical! Janine Basinger, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. I was looking forward to our conversation.
Oh, I was too. The whole time I was reading this book, I was thinking, oh, I can't wait to talk about it. But I know you teach film, and this is a course. This is an actual, it's like taking a course.
Well, you know, it began, of course, as a real course. I do teach musical film to students, and I have done that for a long time, since the early 1970s. And the first time that I set about saying to the university, I'm going to teach a course on the musical film, as I always like to say, they laughed when I sat down at the piano. I mean, nobody took it seriously. They could not believe I was going to do it. They tried to talk me out of it. And that's sort of the fate of the musical. It's like people just didn't want to, for many years, give it its due, take it seriously, or believe it could have depth, creativity, and imagination in all the ways it obviously does. And over the years, I found that students, when introduced to the musical and presented it with respect, that they fell in love with the genre, with the films, and it was very rewarding to teach. And so I finally decided I really want to turn this course into a book, although obviously I added a great many things that aren't in the course to the book. But it is based on a course and on my experience showing musicals to a different generation, to people who hadn't grown up on them and hadn't been told that they were worthwhile, always been told they were worthwhile. So it was a good experience doing the courses over the years and doing the book.
It's interesting that the two incredibly popular genres of the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, the musical and the Western, are both, you know, pretty much gone now.
They are, and they are two quintessential American genres, really. I mean, obviously, the Western, we're the ones with the West, so that was really an American genre. And, you know, a lot of books have been written on the Western, and a lot of analysis goes into it, and Westerns are taught a great deal in colleges by people in all sorts of different departments. But the musical is not so much recognized as an American art form, the musical movie, I mean, and it doesn't have the same kind of analysis and respect, not really. But it's true, they're kind of, the musical is kind of with us still and is making more of a comeback in the last few years. And we always have MTV and things like that, but the Western really suffers. It is actually kind of dead, I suppose. The space adventure has replaced it. I don't know what to say. I love Westerns myself, of course.
Oh, yeah. Well, many of the space science fiction stories are basically high noon in space.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Well, your book, Janine Basinger, the Movie Musical, it's so delightful that I don't know where to start, but I think if you talked a little bit like you do in the book about the difference between Busby Berkeley and Fred Astaire and their approach, because I think those two really run the gamut of what you can do with a musical.
Yeah, they're so interesting because they're really the yin and yang of it, I suppose, or whatever you want to call it, because Astaire, both of them were tremendously concerned about the audience's viewing experience and pleasure in it, and the camera. But their approach to it was completely different. Astaire said, either I will dance or the camera will dance. He said, the camera must focus on the dancer, must show the dancer head to toe, and as much as possible, present the dance as an uninterrupted piece of movement of the dancing person through space. And he really wanted to have respect for the integrity of the dance. Any cuts were to be incorporated into the choreography and the plan for it to be as if they weren't really there. Berkeley is the opposite. In a way, he says, the camera will dance and everybody else will stand still. He does have numbers in which a lot of tapping dancers are moving and tapping, but he liked to take the eye of the camera and make it the eye of the audience and treat the movement inside the frame as this formation of mathematical precision or a kaleidoscopic effect of moving parts that was almost like looking down on something inhuman. So he was about cinema in using the camera movement to create a vision that an audience could never have if they were in a theater, whereas Astaire was using the camera to present a look at the dancer in close-up and detail in a way they really couldn't have in a theater either. Even if they were sitting down close, it wouldn't be the same. So they were both very cinematic, very concerned with camera usage, camera movement, and what the audience was seeing, but their opinions on what that should be differed. And so together they gave the wide range of possibilities to people making dance musicals, and they're very, very important to film history in that regard. Obviously, there wasn't any place much for the Berkeley attitude to go over time, because it was about spectacle, and people like intimacy in movies, and they like characters doing the musical numbers, and so his type of presentation became less popular and really sort of faded out or returned only as a kind of campy experience. But Astaire's way of doing it remained, grew, and was developed even further by others who came along later, like Gene Kelly, who's a very important person in the development of photographing dance on film.
Well, Busby Berkeley, in addition to, as you described, you know, he was kind of, he had a certain insanity, which I think led to the revival of his work during the 60s when recreational drug use was at its zenith.
Yes, his presentation of crazy patterns, moving, shifting, changing, and polka dots and colors and explosions and going in somebody's eyeball and coming out of somebody's eyeball was perfect for the 60s. It's like his own sort of weird mind anticipated, you know, what was going to come and what people wanted to see later. And he was, in his private life, he did not live a calm, sober, sensible life, which actually Fred Astaire lived a sensible life. He was very professional, and Berkeley had all kinds of problems in life. And so, you know, these are personal presentations that they have as well as professional.
Well, you pointed out in your book the Busby Berkeley number that I'd sort of forgotten was that's in color, because I always think of Busby Berkeley as the Warner Brothers, you know, Gold Diggers phase.
Yes.
But you talked about the Carmen Miranda number where there's these giant bananas.
One of my favorite numbers. And the gang's all here, which, as you correctly say, it doesn't seem like a Busby Berkeley number because it's in blazing Technicolor and we really associate him with black and white. But the gang's all here with that fabulous bananas number and the polka dot ballet number at, you know, all of that stuff. It's really kind of the high point of Berkeley. It's sort of the quintessential madness of what it is he's doing with the color added. But I like the black and white Warner Brothers Busby Berkeley. I love those formations he does and all those women wearing blonde wigs and white satin dresses with white pianos, whatever. I love that stuff. You know, it's interesting that you can just look at those numbers over and over and over again, and they always seem to be appearing for the first time, because you can't remember all of that stuff in your mind, all that movement and those formations. You have to re-experience looking at it to kind of get them. And so I always enjoy seeing Busby Berkeley.
Yes, you can just kind of, I mean, the movies themselves are delightful, especially Footlight Parade, but you can isolate the numbers. Like, I think it's, I don't know which film has the Lullaby of Broadway, but that's like a little movie in itself.
Yeah, the thing about the Busby Berkeley movie musical number is it isn't integrated into the plot, really, except in some loose way. And you can take those numbers out and everything in the plot functions, and you can look at those numbers separately, and you don't really have to know anything about the story to appreciate them. And that's the thing that makes them, you know, kind of fun for doing clips and showing young kids what it was really like in those days to see these things. And, you know, when you think about how the heck did he plan these, the mind that envisions something like Lullaby of Broadway really just, you know, makes you wonder, doesn't it? I mean, that's, by the way, it's from Gold Diggers of 1935.
Uh-huh.
It's an extended number of great complexity, and it actually tells a story from beginning to end, a sort of 24-hour period, and all kinds of things happen inside it, including someone falling to her death. I mean, you know, the mind that conceived this kind of choreography is very important to film history, but Busby Berkeley's, because he really is the person who says movie dancing, musicals on film, are not theater. This, folks, is a different universe. Because here you can create a musical number with all kinds of things through editing and camera movement and depth that you could never do on stage. And so he really proves that you can break down that proscenium arch and go off into cuckoo land in a musical number. And it's great stuff. It really is.
Now, with Astaire, he was an actor, of course, and a pretty good, I think he's a great actor. And
I do too.
And,
I do too.
And his acting doesn't stop when he dances.
No, he does not. And neither does Kelly's. And that was one of the things about both of them. They understood they were playing a character. And that's a musical number, the song and the dance, or just the dance, whatever, had to be the character's expression of an emotion and an attitude. That you didn't just stop and then do a dance because your character could dance. Your character danced to express who the character was and what the character was feeling. Astaire is the great wooer of women through the dance, bringing a woman into his partnership, showing her some fun roller skating or whatever, dancing in the rain, whatever. I mean, these people knew to make the dance part of the character and part of the story. And I like, Fred Astaire is very natural. You can't last on film for as long as he lasted in a high level of success if you're artificial or false or unbelievable. People felt comfortable in who he was. He was easy with it, just as he was easy with the song or easy with the dance. He's easy with his character, and he flows easily into the number. When he does Night and Day with Ginger Rogers in The Gay Divorce, he woos her through the dance and brings her to him. She's against him. He has to woo her and bring her into his arms, into his world, and into his friendship as a character, and he just does that beautifully. I think Fred Astaire is fantastic. I really think his work stands the test of time, as well as anybody's in the history of film. He has such grace, you know, and such a kind of easy, natural manner. He's never false. He doesn't, I guess you might say, put a foot wrong in either dance or non-dance moments.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and my guest this week is film historian Janine Basinger. Her new book is called The Movie Musical. Janine Basinger, talk a little bit about the differences between the styles of Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly.
Kelly is a different type of dancer. Kelly and Astaire are both able to do the things that each other do, but Astaire is a lighter, he's more of a souffle. I mean, you know, Kelly is a more athletic dancer. He taps closer to the ground. He dances a little bit, and he does athletics inside his dance in a conscious way. They have different body types, and of course, that's going to affect the look of the dance and their choreography. Kelly very consciously intellectualized the dance on film more. He was very concerned with respect for dance, with bringing into the dance on film a sort of kinetic energy that you would have if you were watching a live dancer. And so his approach is more, he's more of a soloist by instinct than Astaire, who can easily pair with someone, which is not to say Kelly can't. You know, they're both very capable, but they're really quite different. And the characters that Kelly plays are a more aggressive male woman chaser type often. And I notice that my students in this day and age don't always open up to the Kelly character and thus to Kelly's own genius in the work he does on film as well as they do to Astaire's. So those are the things that happen as times change. You know, they find Kelly's character less likable. But the dances that they do are both very important in storytelling. They don't abandon character and story when they go to do a musical number. And that was so important to the integration of the musical and to its growth as an art form.
Fred Astaire, it's interesting because both of those men sing, and I think they both sing well. But Fred Astaire introduced more popular songs with more standards than Bing Crosby or Frank Sinatra or any known singer. We don't think of Astaire as a singer, but so many great songs were written for him.
Isn't that wonderful? Irving Berlin made that great comment once in which he said, "I'd rather have Fred Astaire introduce one of my songs than anyone else." And, of course, Fred Astaire was a songwriter. I mean, he wrote songs. He had some success with it. He could play instruments. He, of course, from early childhood had been involved in dance and rhythm and been immersed in popular song. He worked with the great songwriters, the Jerome Kearns, the George Gershwins, the Berlins. I mean, he absolutely understood the rhythm of a song, and thus his approach to it was to treat it like a dance, like a piece of musical communication in which the words were like the taps of his shoes or whatever. And he just presented the song impeccably as a musical piece, but also as a conversation with the viewer. And then the viewer listens as well as views and hears this character speaking through the song, and thus the song became more memorable, more popular. It's a great thing, you know. Really, he does sing a song fabulously well, and Kelly is good too, but there's something about Astaire's singing that is, he has the better voice of the two. I know Kelly always worried about his singing and thought his voice wasn't good enough, but he does know how to put a number across very beautifully, and the huskiness of his singing suits his own type of masculinity and his own type of character that he plays. But it's when you look at the songs that Astaire introduced and what he did for them, wow, it's an amazing list.
Well, Jeanine Basinger, in your book, the movie musical, you even talk about Finian's Rainbow with
yes.
Fred Astaire. And that's a movie a lot of people, you know, either have never heard of or didn't like when it came out. And I'm a big fan of it. I think it's a beautiful movie and orchestrations and all.
You know what? I love you for liking Finian's Rainbow. You and I are a club of two. There's the two of us. And I'm sure there are other people out there, too, because Finian's Rainbow has a wonderful score, and Astaire is really wonderful in it. I think Francis Ford Coppola, who directed it, is a really underrated director of musicals. He has an instinct for understanding musical presentation and how to do it. The problem with Finian's Rainbow is that its story has become dated, and it's a story that makes people uncomfortable, involving, you know, attitudes toward race, etc. And so I think that's one of the reasons people don't look at it. But the presentation of Fred Astaire in his final musical real character performance on film could not be more beautifully done, because he is allowed a great dancing exit out of frame while Petula Clark sings. It is Petula Clark, right? Yes.
Yes.
Howard sings in La Camorra, a really beautiful song. And, you know, moments like that, we don't get a lot of those where a great star who's been at the top of the profession and has kept going, and even as an old man, is a viable character, as Astaire is here, to see them on film make their goodbye by dancing out of frame. It's really quite wonderful, and I'm glad you like it.
Well, let's just take a moment and listen to a little bit of Finian's Rainbow, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. This is Petula Clark and Fred Astaire.
How'd you get so pretty? And so rich?
Oh, well, you see, back in Glockamara, where we come from, there's an old legend. And it says, you'll never grow old, and you'll never grow poor if you look to the rainbow beyond the next moor.
That's a lovely legend.
Aye.
Wonder who thought it up.
Me father. Finian McLonagan.
On the day she was born, said her father, said he, I've an elegant legacy waiting for ye. 'Tis a rhyme for your lip and a song for your heart, to sing it whenever the world falls apart. Look, look, look to the rainbow. Follow it over the hill and stream. Look, look, look to the rainbow. Follow the fellow who follows a dream.
So I bundled me heart and I roamed the world free, to the east with the lark, to the west with the sea. And I searched all the earth, and I scanned all the skies, but I found it at last in my own true love's eyes.
Look, look, look to the rainbow. Follow it over the hill and stream. Look, look, look.
That was Fred Astaire and Petula Clark from the Francis Ford Coppola film Finian's Rainbow, a full discussion of which can be found in the movie musical, the great new book by my guest Jeanine Basinger. Brings up an interesting question, which is the Broadway musical is a beautiful, thriving art form, and it's great. But and film musicals are great, but Broadway musicals don't always, in fact, frequently don't make good cinema.
I know. What is the deal with that? Well, you know, I've thought about this a lot. I think that's a wonderful question to ask, because I gave that a lot of thought, and I think one of the issues, like when you look at Carousel, a beautiful, beautiful show on the stage. I don't think I've ever seen it done when I didn't just break down and bawl in it, you know? And believe me, I've seen it done by amateurs. I've seen eighth graders doing it, you know, and I'm always bawling no matter what. But the movie, I can sit right there and not feel a thing. One of the things that happens when you have these great Broadway shows is the mindset of the filmmakers was, and we'd like to just give you that Broadway show. And that's kind of what they do. They sort of photograph it flat, and especially when, because they were being done in widescreen, kind of just as if you are just sitting in the Broadway theater, and all the greatness that had been learned about how to make a movie musical and turn it into cinema and bring you up out of the audience and into it for that vicarious thrill of singing and dancing, they just kind of leave that and present it too respectfully. They're too respectful of the Broadway experience, and I think maybe that's part of what goes wrong. I don't know. And of course, there's always issues of casting, you know, that kind of thing. If you have all due respect to Gordon McRae's great singing voice, but if at Carousel you had Frank Sinatra playing that role instead of Gordon McRae, it might be different. I mean, who knows? There are a lot of issues, but I think there's an overly respectful approach often to it. Let's preserve the Broadway show and forget about cinema from my point of view.
One that I liked was How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And I think I like it because Robert Morse has such a marvelous face that the cinema helps with his comedy.
Yes, and we get more from the comedy because we can go up close and see him better. And it's a fun, there's a lot of comedy. You know, it's the kind of Broadway musical that in some ways is more comedy than it is music. Maybe that's not quite true, but you get the bonus of all the comedy in it, so it helps carry it in cinema, I think, and make it more fun.
I saw Carousel on Broadway last year, and Renee Fleming was singing.
Wow.
And you know, it was like watching, everybody in the place was in tears, and it was sort of like watching Babe Ruth hit a home run at Yankee Stadium.
Yes. Oh, boy. You were very lucky to see. That is the most beautiful musical. I cry. As I said, you know, it's very deeply moving, that musical. When you see a good production of it, it's a great experience. And the film is disappointing. It doesn't, there are good people in it, there's much in it that's good, but it doesn't have the same depth of emotional effect, I feel. This is my opinion, of course.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and my guest this week is Janine Basinger. She's a great film historian, and her new book is called The Movie Musical. In your book, you talked a little bit about The Coconuts, the Marx Brothers' first film,
right.
and you sort of kind of put it in the category of, well, it's a Marx Brothers movie. But all of the Marx Brothers movies, many of the Abbott and Costello movies, and at least three that I can think of, Laurel and Hardy movies, and I know you love Laurel and Hardy.
I adore them.
Or musicals. They did those comic operettas that were.
They did, yes.
You don't consider those to be part of the movie musical?
Well, I do. I certainly do. I mean, I certainly do. The thing is, the issue is, though, we are calling them the Marx Brothers movies. We are calling them the Laurel and Hardy movies. We are calling them the Abbott and Costello movies, which means we aren't calling them the musical, the Coconut. We're calling them by what actually is the dominant box office force of the movie, which is the comedy of the Marx Brothers, the comedy of Abbott and Costello, and the comedy of Laurel and Hardy, with musical numbers. It isn't, you know, because there are movies that are musicals with the Radio Rogues doing their comedy, and I can tell you, if you've ever seen the Radio Rogues, there's a reason why we're not calling them the Radio Rogues movies, but they're not very funny. But here's the thing, I mean, that's the stress and the balance of the movie is given more to the comedy, to the plot of the comedy, and the musical numbers are woven in. And Abbott and Costello don't do the musical numbers. The Marx Brothers do, and Laurel and Hardy will do them, but the Abbott and Costello don't actually do the music part. I mean, you know, so the decision on what to call a musical and where you draw the line is a really tough one. So where's the focus? Where's the star focus? Where's the box office focus? Where's the plot focus? You know, you have to, in some cases, just draw an arbitrary line. I mean, I do think those films are musicals, which is why I chose to write about The Coconuts. And I would have written more about Laurel and Hardy, but I had written about their musical numbers, my favorite one, extensively in another book. So I decided I'm using the Marx Brothers. I'll just go on. But there are a lot of movies that have, if you do Real Rita with Abbott and Costello, this is at the beginning of their movie career, and that is a musical. They're not yet, you know, quite the dominant stars, but when they start making Abbott and Costello movies with musical numbers inside them, you know, it's a case of emphasis. And since I was trying to write about how do musicals work and tell the overall history of the evolution of the genre, I had to make choices. The book is already 600 and some pages long. I thought, you know, boy, this is never going to end. I had to leave out things, and I had to make choices. But I'm glad you mentioned that, because I definitely do see those, what I would call them is comedy musicals, not musical comedy. You know, the comedy is more important than the music, but the music matters, definitely.
In the Abbott and Costello pictures of the 40s, they would regularly have the top jukebox stars. Yeah, the Andrews sisters. And oftentimes those would be African-American performers. Ella Fitzgerald drops
exactly.
in, and Tip, Tap, and Toe, and the Ink Spots. And that made me they're put in such a way that they could easily be removed to not offend people in the South. But I don't think anybody would have actually been offended, but I guess they were very careful about that.
I wonder, I mean, I often think about that. I wonder if there's a real history of that issue anywhere, because one of the things later in my book, I do write extensively about all the great musical performers, African-American, that we saw only briefly. I love the Nicholas Brothers. I love the Berry Brothers. I mean, and I lament, couldn't we have had more? I mean, it seems like such a terrible loss. I adore Fats Waller. I mean, couldn't we have had more? But I wonder, you know, you always say, but these were put so they could be cut out, and clearly they are put so they can be cut out, because they aren't attached to anything that came before or that followed. But did people actively cut these musical numbers as a regular habit? I wonder about that, because they're so innocuous. I mean, they're not characters in anything. They're just people coming on and doing a musical number. This is one of those repeated things, and I would like to see a history of that, like which theaters cut them, and when they cut them, what did they do with what they cut? Or did the studio cut it prior to sending the print there?
Uh-huh.
I've never seen any actual writing that, I'm sure it's out there somewhere and I just haven't found it, but you know, I'm curious about the frequency, who did it, when, and how would be interesting to me. And what a loss. Bill Bojangles, we didn't get Robinson, we didn't get enough of him. The beautiful, wonderful Lena Horne. I mean, it's sad, isn't it, that they were not given characters to play and presented more with all that wonderful talent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you think of Judy Garland, and she's such a marvelous, of course, she's a great singer, and one of the reasons she's a great singer is that she's such a great actress. I mean, it's kind of those two things go together.
Yes.
And if you think of a singer like, say, Billie Holiday, who's, you know, Judy Garland's equal, maybe not in range, but in emotional range, certainly.
Yes.
Would Billie Holiday have been a great actress, I wonder?
I would say absolutely, because she certainly was when she put over a song to us. When she talked to us in a song, we knew the emotion. We felt it, we heard it. And we could have seen it also, I'm sure, because you just know it's there. You just know it's there.
I want to talk about some of the unusual people that are probably forgotten today. Jeanine Basinger from your book, The Movie Musical, particularly Esther Williams and Sonja Henie.
I love Esther Williams and Sonja Henie. These were two stars of my youth, especially Esther Williams. I was born in 1936, so I did see some Sonja Henie movies. She didn't make a lot of movies, but she did make some in the 40s. But my older sisters had Sonja Henie paper dolls, and my great desire was to have a Sonja Henie ice skating doll when I was very little. And my parents, my mother said, no, she's got ice skates on, you'll cut yourself. And I never got my, I mean, it was like, you know, it was like my holy grail. And one of the great events of my life was that on my 75th birthday, many of my ex-students gave me a party, and one of them gave me that Sonja Henie doll from the 1940 Sears catalog, and I'm like, I've got her, she's right here. And yes, she does have ice skates on, but so far I've not caught myself on them. Anyway, that's an aside. It's a wonderful thing to think that Hollywood was shrewd when they saw these two attractive athletes who could do these things, swim and skate, that it occurred to them, swimming and skating are physical acts not unlike dancing. These are two good-looking women. What about putting them in musicals and doing skating numbers and swimming numbers and treating it like musical presentation? I mean, you know, that's pretty darn great, really. Now, it's not so far-fetched to think of ice skating, because obviously an ice skater skates to music anyway, but to think of a swimming star. And of course, the ideas, there were aquacades, there were, you know, aqua shows and hippodrome shows with Annette Kellerman, everything before, but it just seemed so wonderful that these two women, against all odds, who really don't sing and dance. I mean, Henie for sure didn't sing. She could dance, but she didn't, because obviously she danced on skates. She knew how to do routines, and Williams could sing a little, dance a little, but that they became top box office draws in these movies. I mean, they were top 10 box office draws, these two women. And it just seems so miraculous and kind of crazy and wonderful. And I love the cuckoo quality of that. I really do. That they were stars, two women athletes, musical stars. Isn't that wonderful? On water, they made musicals out of water. They froze it and they heated it up, and there they went. Isn't that wonderful?
And it's not like there's only two or three Esther Williams movies. It's like,
that's right,
25.
That's right. She was a real star. She lasted. Henie, of course, made so much money doing her ice skating shows, and she was a real diva. So she made only about 11 movies, but nevertheless, it's a reasonable. She was a career, you know, name. They sold Sonja Henie skates, clothes, skating outfits, paper dolls, coloring books, everything with her. She was a big deal. But Esther Williams lasted, and that's quite wonderful. She was a very intelligent, woman with real business sense. Both of these women were good at business, actually.
You have a marvelous chapter in your book where you compare the great American popular vocalists and their films, from Jolson through Crosby, Sinatra, and into Presley. Who's the best actor of those great singers?
Crosby, I think. Crosby, you know, Crosby is the man who rose to musical fame because of the microphone. The thing is, Jolson rose to fame belting it out because he had a big voice and he's singing before that huge amplification. Crosby became successful on the bandstand in front of a microphone and on radio and records, and then moved into film. And Presley, of course, was also a live performer and a recording performer, already famous when he started making movies. I think it's easy to underestimate Elvis Presley. If you look at the films he made where he was given a chance to do something, he's very sensitive and natural and easy. I think Elvis Presley is wonderful. I'm a big Elvis Presley fan. And I came to really respect Al Jolson and what he was and the energy he brought. But Crosby is a real actor. In Country Girl, he's terrific as an actor. He's so convincing in Going My Way, a movie that, by all rights, should never have been the best film of the year, you know, for me. But Crosby is at ease in front of the camera and standing before a microphone. He's natural, relaxed, and believable. And when a moment of challenge comes dramatically, he can meet it. He can bring emotion up. It's like he came along just about the right time for the microphone and the movie projector, and he just fits in that world. So I think if you're asking who's the best actor, Crosby. And he acts his songs in the same way we were talking about with a Judy Garland or someone. He acts his songs. You can believe what he's singing, although he's very casually back about it. There's bombast in Jolson's presentation, and there's nice hot sex in Presley's presentation. But Crosby is more the one, I think. And that's no knock on either Jolson or Presley, because I do think the three of them are really great and very distinctive, and each in his own way. And of course, I grew up, I came into my teenage years just at the right moment for Elvis Presley, so you know I'm a Presley fan.
King Creole is a particularly good
Elvis movie. Yes, very good in Flaming Star. I mean, he could have done so much more. I mean, had they let him, or he really was just used to promote and sell some very weak films. The films are all about him and his singing and dancing. I mean, he was the attraction. Viva Las Vegas is a real movie musical, and he has a real movie musical partner, Anne Margaret, who's at her best musically. So that's like a wonderful musical. But he could have done more in the acting. I believe he could have.
Well, I want my listeners to know that this book, the movie musical, it's almost a coffee table book. I mean, it's not gigantic, but it's larger and it's thick. And you might think, well, it's not a readable book, but it's so readable. And there's so many wonderful things that we haven't talked about. Jeanine Basinger takes us through in each studio and takes us through the blondes that ruled 20th Century Fox one after the other. It's such a so many great things in this book, and what an achievement it is. And Jeanine Basinger, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to talk to you, because I know you love movies, and I always enjoy that. And obviously, I love these films a great deal. I grew up with this; it meant a lot to me. So So I appreciate very much your having me on your show and your reading the book and being a fan of it. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.